Interview with Sarah Hanks, February 4, 2008, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. I definitely want to start covering your background a little bit.
Okay.
And I noticed that you're from the U.K.
Yeah.
And you got your education there.
I did. And the reason I ended up in Washington in the first place is that I always thought that I would do international securities type law, although I had no idea what it was when I first started that. But I always thought that I would international securities law, starting out in London, and then maybe I would go to Hong Kong or something like that.
I mean, always as in...
Since I was 17 years old.
Huh.
I had no idea what it is. It's just like, oh yeah, moving money around, the world. That sounds really good.
Uh-huh.
Then when I was at Oxford, I met an American who was an American serviceman. And we thought, okay, well, you know, let's try and get it so that he can maybe work at NATO headquarters while I'm in London. The U.S. Army had other ideas about, you know, my life. And so the way it happened was I took up articles, which was then called articles, is now traineeship, with the law firm I had chosen, Norton Rose, in London. At this point, we were already married. Totally failing to get Lonnie, my husband, anywhere close to where I was. We didn't see each other for more than 2 weeks in the first year, 2 years of our marriage. He was sent to Arizona, then Korea, then Washington. Towards the end of my traineeship, I realized it just wasn't going to work, me against the U.S. Army. So I decided to move. Actually, the date I decided to move was February 14th, it must have been 1983. So I decided that I would move to the U.S. So after I'd qualified in London, I tried to find a job in international work over here. Of course, in Washington in the early 1980s, there really wasn't very much international work. So I'd applied to a few of the major firms that I'd heard of. I'd met a few people in London who'd helped. But there was this one guy from Rogers and Wells who was over in London negotiating a Eurobond. And one of my friends, who I wasn't a deal I was in, but one of my friends knew my interest and said, here's my friend's resume. She wants to move to Washington. That guy and I had breakfast the next morning and he offered me a job on the spot. That was a chap called John Lifton who... later went on to become general counsel of various things like Kidder Peabody and Bank of New York.
Okay.
Then he actually left after I'd been at Rogers and Wells for about 18 months. He left to take up a general counselship at a now defunct investment bank. At which point all of the good international work that he had, because of him, went back to the New York office of Rogers and Wells, and I was sort of left there as a second-year associate going, okay, well, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. He mentioned my name to Linda Quinn at the SEC. She said, I'll come over for an interview. And the rest is history. They offered me a job as an attorney fellow.
So about 1985, somewhere in there?
It was 1986. It was summer of 86.
What was your understanding of the SEC at that time? Had you had much experience?
Yeah, on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Interpreting the rules, which I later went on to rewrite, release 4708 and the no action letters that's based on that. One thing that I saw was I learned a lot from John Lifton. I was only working for him about 18 months, 2 years at most. I could see the people that he admired in the securities industry, and I went to all of these conferences. And it looked like when you looked at the resumes of all of the people who had knowledge and understanding, they'd all spent some time at the SEC. Everybody who was anybody had spent some time, apart from those in firms like Cravath who just never leave. But everybody else had gone through the SEC. So it was like I could see its internal, standing within the securities community was obviously very high. It was clear that's where you got the knowledge. And then also, you know, just spending time on the other side of the SEC, we went trying to get a no-action letter. I was just very impressed by their intellect. And they were very different from private practice people, because private practice people were wearing fancy suits and everything.
Right.
Going into the SEC in the 80s, where everybody outside was very formal, you go into the SEC and people were wearing short sleeves rolled up, and it was just... And what they cared about most was the law and not anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Just very impressed with the organisation from the outside.
How about Linda Quinn?
I had never met her before I went over for an interview. But, you know, once I met her, you know, how could you not be inspired by someone like that? She had amazing... she was the big picture woman. You know, mm-hmm. She could step back and say, that's the important thing. And everybody else, you know, being lawyers, we tend to get bogged down in the details. She was absolutely amazing at stepping back and saying, this is important. This is how this pattern of laws works.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, incredibly bright.
Well, speaking of patterns of laws, the interesting thing here is that you were trained in the UK. You were a solicitor or licensed to practice
in the
UK.
Yeah, solicitor.
And here you are in this American institution that revolves around American securities law.
Yeah.
What was that transition like? What kind of perspective did you bring into this?
Well, getting in was actually interesting because I think I was the first foreigner ever to work for the SEC. They thought so as well. And then I hired the second foreigner. Because what happened was, at that time, I did not have U.S. citizenship, which I was only eligible for when I'd been here 3 years. And so when I'd called the SEC when John Lifton left Rogers and Wells, and said, do you have to be a citizen? They said, oh, yes. But then this other, you know, just this introduction to Linda was opened up, and I sort of let it go, because it was obvious, you know, from my resume and the accent at the time that I was an American. And then as we got to the point of the offer, I talked to the personnel office and said, you do realise I'm not American, right? And they say, it's all right, you're members of NATO. I'm like, okay, securities, I don't know what...
Whatever.
so long as I can come and work here, that's fine. I think from what people had said, and certainly I wasn't aware at the time of anybody else who was foreign at the same time, and we ran into problems when I tried to get an unpaid Dutch intern into the office a couple of years later, and it was really quite a lot of fuss. And I went in as an attorney fellow, maybe it was easier then. Now, these days, I do see that there are people who are clearly not citizens, and I don't know if the rules have changed or whatever, but so there was just the you know, the logistical problems of of going through, and then of course I sounded weird whenever I was on the phone, but the adjustment intellectually was really very easy. You take two countries, and Britain was a long way behind the US and has been influenced by the US in securities law very much since. But you take two democracies based on common law with common cultural things as far as business regulation is concerned, and you end up at pretty much the same place. I mean, you know, the Brits, it's a national sport criticising the SEC, but they have followed the SEC down so many roads. And
was disclosure central to the way that Britain was doing it?
No. The whole disclosure-based regime, that's something that the SEC has influenced on the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the concept of registration is different in the US, in the UK. But there are proxies for every sort of regulation. There's a proxy in the other jurisdiction. So I didn't find it any more difficult, I think, than moving from one state to another.
Okay.
It just seemed kind of obvious, all of it.
So did you come into CorpFin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what work were you set to do?
Well, I started off, I was an attorney fellow at first, the general idea was, you know, you take people who've got experience on the outside. And of course, I only had 18 months experience. It's not like a... I did have fun and I did work hard. Doing no action responses at first, I was working for Bill Morley in the General Counsel's office. And so responding to no action requests. And of course, in those days, you know, we couldn't get typing time. We had no computers. We used to write these things out by hand. I had good handwriting, so that probably helped the analysis. But that was a lot of fun because you were able to take discrete areas and study them in depth. That's actually come back to haunt me in later years because there's a series of letters that I was involved in 86, 87 or whatever it was, where my partners have seen my name. Oh, you're an expert in this area. And it's something that I never looked at for the last 20 plus years. Right. I've really got no knowledge about it. But at that point, you know, I did learn a lot about some very discrete areas and then was able to start putting those together as this is the time when we started working on 144A and Regulation S and the multi-jurisdictional mm-hmm. disclosure system. Mm-hmm. And I'd been working, as well as doing the general counsel stuff, I started working on those rules.
Were these no action letters that you were working on, did these have to do with international companies?
Absolutely. But everybody knew, I went in with the view that I wanted to do international, because I was a foreigner. So okay.
Right.
So it wasn't until Carl Badolas resigned that I sort of moved over to the Office of International Corporate Finance and became the head. And at that point, we'd actually been spending some time working on these rules. And Carl resigned, and Linda called me in and said, you know, how does Carl's... I was still an attorney fellow, which you know, had a finite term. And she said, how does this affect you? And I said, well, I don't know. She said, don't be dumb. Do you want the job? I said, oh, yeah, that will be good. And so I took the job. They went through, of course, all the usual ways of hiring people. But
yeah. How long had this Office of International Corporate Finance been around?
I don't know. Carl was its first chief. I know that. Carl had actually joined the SEC the month I was born, so it was kind of passing of the torch there. It had existed certainly as long as I'd been in the country, so you know, at least 4 or 5 years. Quite a time. I saw stuff when I took over. I saw stuff dating back to the 70s.
Okay, what was the office's purview? What did it do?
To do all of the weird international stuff. At the time Carl had it, there were two or three people at most in that office. And when I went over there, we expanded a lot because we moved all of the international rules over there. There was Carl Badolas and Jan Albright. I can't remember if there was anybody else at that time. But they were supposed to, as they do now, I mean, Paul Dudek still does, it's... there is interpretation of the existing rules, mm-hmm. working on current or new rules that affect international companies, the review of international companies, filings, and all of those things are still done.
What was the bulk of the work? Was it reviewing the filings?
In Carl's time, yes, until we got into the rule writing. And then it became very much the rule writing took a large chunk of the office, and that's one reason it got expanded. Because the rule writing previously, not that there was that much on international, that was done by the, I forget what it was called, but it was like the rule writing office. Mm. But then they moved all of the international stuff into the same office, and we went to 6 attorneys pretty quickly.
Okay. Now, was this around 1987 or so that you...
That would have been... 87, 88.
Okay.
Not clear on the...
Because a landmark that shows up here is the 1987 study about the internationalization of the securities.
Yeah. I moved offices after that. I worked on the study.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons that I ended up in the international office.
What kind of work did you do on this study?
Research, and it was so difficult in those days. I mean, you know, just finding the people. Nowadays, you know, you start off on the internet, but we decided, you know, I helped work on the structure of the study, what it should cover, then also on the, as it became obvious that we weren't able to get a lot of information, diminishing, it's like, okay, well, we won't say anything about that because we can't find it for all of these other jurisdictions.
Now, this was, because the study's broken up into you know, offices or...
Yeah, I just did the corporation finance part.
Okay.
And then there was also coordinating with the other guys like Market Reg and stuff like that.
Okay. Was there much talk about the genesis of this study? Was this something that was really, you know, in demand, or did it seem like just a project that was going along by itself?
I think there was a perceived need for new rules in so many different places. You know, the 15A6 and the 144A and the, you know, maybe a perception that we've lost some market ground with forcing the euro markets, creating the euro markets, creating this offshore euro bond market by reason of tax regulations.
Your sense is that the U.S. created that euro bond market?
Yeah.
Okay. And so there was recognition of that?
Yeah. And so trying to see what we could do to regain an institutional market that we'd sort of forced offshore. And then just a need for guidance in so many other areas, all of which turned out to be international and all of which turned out to be linked in some way.
Hmm. How had we forced that market offshore?
Tax regulations. Gosh. I would have to go back and sort of recreate that.
Don't need the specifics.
Yeah, it was not so much a securities thing. It was a tax driven market that happened even before I got here to the States.
So if taxes drove this market away,
how could securities bring it back? By making it easier, because then there was a change in the tax laws in 1984, I think.
Okay.
It was right around the time I arrived in this country, at which point you could have brought the markets back, but there was no real trading. And that's when people said, we need a way for these, we need an institutional trading market like the one they have over there in Europe.
Okay. Did you have any interface with the Senate or the House committees that had commissioned this thing in the first place?
No, not me.
Okay. Any other stories or any other information you can give me about the process of working out that study?
It was like pulling teeth. I mean, just because one of the ways that we'd arranged it is like, what do they do about registration in other countries? Well, the problem is that you don't have the same concept of registration, so you've got to look for proxies for, what do you do to ensure that information gets into the public markets? So the questions that we were asking of the people that we could find, and finding the people to ask the questions was a big issue, but we were constantly reframing the questions that we were asking so that we're trying to make it make sense in their own jurisdiction.
So you're looking for analogs all the time.
Yeah.
Well, that gets to what it sounds like must have been one of the sort of one of the fairly big activities, which is this whole idea of reconciliation. If overseas offeror wants to, you know, put their issue something here, they have to reconcile everything. Did your office help with that at all?
Well, reconciliation on the financial side, you mean?
Yeah.
We dealt with it a lot. We were never going to... It was clear that was always going to be an issue in the near future. Round about that time is when the SEC started playing a big role in IOSCO and the accounting committees. There was also a reorganization of... Maybe it started not being IOSCO and then it got moved to somebody else. But that's when the work started. The problem was... The SEC at that point, and you could say maybe they're a bit parochial, but other financial systems, so many of them were absolutely terrible. I mean, you know, you could have the ability of Germany, for example, to smooth out earnings, because German accounts at that time were very much aimed towards creditors. So creditors care, are you going to stay solvent, not can I see how your profits have grown year on year. So the ability to move money from slush accounts to smooth out your earnings was perfectly legitimate under German accounting rules at the time. And I think Switzerland the same. There were many jurisdictions had the ability to have a line item for convenient payments, i.e. bribery. So you could just put it down there in your financial statements. And so most other people's financials really weren't very good at the time. And there was a lot of pressure even there, knowing coming, I don't know whether it came from Cleary, but it definitely came from the Wall Street firms, you know, can't we please trade in the United States without reconciliation? Mm-hmm. And there was at least one attempt to do that. It got nowhere, because the problem was the SEC's view was investor protection. If you're going to be listed on the U.S. exchanges, you can't have crappy financials.
And it sounds like investor protection is down the list for foreign.
It was at the time. I mean, it was a different type of investors. I mean, you can look at the Germans and say creditors. Oh, absolutely protected. They know whether they'll get repaid. But long-term investors, because this is also the days where there wasn't that much retail interest in securities. So everybody's financial systems were geared to a system in which the people who needed protecting were creditors. The stakeholders were seen as being employees, not so much individual investors, because they didn't have so many individual investors. Hmm. I mean, the environment's changed hugely over the last 20 years.
Where did you pick up this knowledge? I mean, is this the kind of thing that you started to piece together as you're working in
I spent some time in the library. I mean, it was an interesting putting jigsaws together. And I frequently went down to the library and had one of those aha moments where you go, oh, so this is what a proxy statement is, or stuff like that. So spending a lot of time reading. I mean, it really was like finishing school at the SEC. It was a wonderful combination of being paid to learn. So it was like doing a securities LLM and getting paid for it.
Hmm. How did once you took over this office? You found three or four people and something that, well, you didn't know how long it had been around, but I guess it must have been had its ways. What were your priorities once you looked around and you wanted to set this thing up on as your own?
Making a few things more efficient. I mean, in those days, everything was in three-ring binders. I mean, we weren't computerized at all. We got computers round about 1986, but still they were basically word processors. Mm-hmm. There's no way you could computers. But for example, little things like ADR filings, Form F6, just having different ways of assigning the review of the Form F6, creating a few new policies with respect to them. There was a couple of things that I'd done where I'd sort of made a decision and had this moment of panic where I go, oh, God, you know, can I possibly be right? And then realizing, well, you know, since you say it, you are, in fact, right by definition. This is the policy of the office. Because I was still very young. Just changing a bit of the process. Okay. And then...
Nothing strategic at this point.
No, nothing strategic. I mean, that wouldn't really have been my job, I think, at that stage.
Mm. Well, whose job would that have been?
That would have been Linda Quinn and Elise Walter. And in fact, putting me there and working on the rules, moving the rulemaking sort of into that office was part of their strategy.
Okay.
And they very much in those days wanted... the SEC was in the process of really engaging the outside world through IOSCO. when IOSCO started, it started, of course, as the organization of America's securities, whatever's, and Carl used to go to it.
Latin America.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Latin America wasn't doing it in those days. They didn't really have any markets. But there was a bit of training and stuff that they did through that. Whereas as IOSCO itself expanded, the SEC's role in IOSCO expanded, and Linda and Elise and the accounting guys played a much larger role in it.
Were they the ones who would go to the meetings?
Yeah, I used to go with Linda to several of them. Especially if they were, because they couldn't afford, you know, we couldn't all afford to go overseas, but mm-hmm. Meetings in the U.S. I would go to.
And what was that like? Were the representatives of the other countries really paying a lot of attention to what the SEC said?
Yeah, because, I mean, the SEC has the ability. A, you've got the expertise. You've got an infrastructure that nobody else had. You had 2,000 employees, I guess, at the time, something like that. Nobody else had anything like that. They didn't have the financial resources. They didn't have the institutional knowledge of how you run this sort of thing. They didn't have the principles. It was a sort of love-hate relationship. You know, the SEC, the U.S. has all the answers, but why do they have to be in charge of everything? there was a lot of give and take.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. How much did the SEC listen then? How were there any aha moments when you're sitting around with all these other folks and you're saying, this is an interesting idea?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, and I can, this is purely anecdotal, obviously. Yeah. It's just, in my experience, it was very much the, here's an interesting problem, let's all discuss it. US, what do you do? This is how we do it. And everyone goes, oh, okay, well, we could do it like that. And a good example of that is the project of IOSCO, whereby they instituted. It's sort of fallen into disuse now because, of course, EU regulations have taken over the whole passporting and disclosure. But disclosure for ongoing reporting and a continuous disclosure of mm-hmm. obligations, where. You know, what is now Form 20F is based on what everybody agreed in IOSCO that we should have, which looked very much like the original 20F. There was hardly any changes by the time. But we said, okay, we're going to adopt the international version of this. Mm-hmm. I'm forever explaining to my associates why this form and no other uses the word host country and home country. But basically, you know, we took the 20F, imposed it on the other countries, and then said, okay, well, this is the result of that project, so here's the new 20F, which looks like the old one.
Okay.
But that was sort of typical for those days, because nobody else had that sort of thing. And, of course, now it's mostly irrelevant, that one.
Mm. Yeah, there are some landmarks for IOSCO in the 80s and maybe early 90s. And I guess what I'm hearing is that those would have generally been bringing something from the SEC and batting it around a little bit and then sending it out as an IOSCO.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, something that's worth covering at this point, I've actually got it elsewhere, but it gets to this idea of, you know, the Americans being the big bullies on the block or whatever, or having all the answers.
Yeah.
And that is the SEC technical assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you involved with that at all?
Just a couple.
In your office?
Yeah.
In what way?
I did some of the training where they brought the people over to Washington. I was involved in that. And then I can't remember if I was involved in the Peruvian one as well, Conosco in Peru. I think that was them coming to the SEC as opposed to the SEC going to them. But I was definitely involved in the, you know, here's how we do it in the U.S. presentations.
What was the mission behind those things? Was
Well, from my point of view, which is very much at the sort of peon level at that stage, it was just here. These are people who have very much fewer resources, and we can teach them, you know, how we do it, how we allocated resources, how we choose to review things, so that you can piggyback. You don't have to work those things out for yourself. And I don't know, I mean, maybe to a certain extent it's a bit of evangelizing. Like, you know, we believe that full disclosure is a really good thing and you should consider this too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example, when the Peruvians came in, did all of this, all of what you were telling them make sense? Was there a time when it seemed like it was not of any interest?
It's difficult to tell. I mean, now you can look and the bulk of my practice is actually in Latin America, because you know, if you do international over here, it's mostly Latin America. Yeah. I mean, now you can look and see here is some very good influence that the SEC has had on the whole of Latin America. I mean, this whole focus on disclosure, the existence of a management's discussion and analysis, for example. The problem was in the 80s, it was part of the lost decade, so there just wasn't that much. So, you know, here's if you actually had a lot of offerings happening in your area, this is what you might ask of them. So maybe some of the things that we said there planted the seeds for later disclosure. And you look now at the Mexicans, you look at the CVM in Brazil especially, huge amount of SEC influence there. I mean, it's just, now the question is, did that come directly from the SEC? But that would have been a long time ago because Brazil was a total basket case at the time. Or did it come through the SEC, the securities lawyers who impose indirectly their disclosure requirements on Brazilian disclosure through the use of their 10b-5 opinions? It's sort of all part of a package. I mean, the SEC influenced us, who are now partners practicing in that area, and we influenced the CVM. So, you know, where did the influence come from? It's there.
Okay. I guess the technical assistance programs might not rank terribly high if you had to, you know, judge.
I think that's true. I think, you know, if you look at, for example, the fact that in the last 4 years in Brazil, which is one of the places I spend most of my time, if you look at the last 4 years in Brazil, 4 years ago, two things sort of coincided. The Brazil sort of returned to a normal economic country and stopped having hyperinflation and stopped just being ridiculous, and also instituted a whole new equity capital markets regulation, Article 400, which is hugely influenced by the SEC disclosure concepts. And because the Brazilian securities markets aren't big enough to absorb very large offerings, all offerings have to be made as well, in addition to being made locally in Brazil, listing there in Brazil and going through the CVM process, they also have to be made in the US. And that means you're using 144A, that means you're using US securities lawyers. US securities lawyers will impose the things they learned from the SEC on a Brazilian offering. So Brazilian bank offerings, for example, now, there is nothing in Brazilian securities law that says banks have to follow Guide 3, the SEC's Guide 3.
Right.
Every single one of them has Guide 3 information in there. Okay. So you've got this whole indirect influence, but it's coming from the lawyers.
That's interesting. Do you recall who was... where this SEC Technical Assistance Program was being operated from?
No.
There was also an Office of International Affairs, I guess.
Yeah, that's Michael Mann.
Okay.
They did more of the enforcement stuff, and they did a lot of coordination with the regulatory authorities. We used to all meet on a weekly basis, talking about, so especially CorpFin, Market Reg, and enforcement, just coordinating what they were doing.
Was there an international component to Market Reg too?
That was Bob Colby. I saw a lot in those days. I think he's still there, actually. But those are the whole 15A6, and you know when you can offer research into the United States and that stuff.
Okay. Well, let's start to get to the big subjects here, and you've discussed it a little bit. The idea that, you know, some new rules were going to have to be written.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this come out of the 87 study? Doing this identification of problems and
sort of. The 87 study identified areas where regulation was needed. Easier resales of restricted securities, which had both domestic and international elements. Clearer jurisdictional guidelines as to what was in the US and what was outside the US. And more reciprocity on the disclosure front, the multi-jurisdictional. All of those, however, pre-existed. I mean, I came over knowing that they were working on the international rules. I mean, it's one of the okay. ways that... So that was I joined October 1986, right at the beginning of October, and had been talking to them through the summer. Linda knew that she was going to be working on these things.
Okay.
I think maybe it wasn't quite so obvious at that stage that 144A was in fact an international thing more than a domestic thing. Hmm. But what later became Regulation S, clearly she knew she needed that. I mean, they had no action letters, literally 3 feet deep at this stage, and it was just getting ridiculous, took far too many resources.
So for everybody who wanted to do an issue in the U.S., you had to give them an
Outside, anyone who had jurisdictional links to the U.S. who wanted to do something outside the U.S., you had to go and get your own letter.
Okay.
And if you wanted to rely on someone else's letter, you had to be quite sure that there was absolutely no differences between you and them. And there was a couple of landmark letters that said, okay, you know, this can be used, or you know, you can have this contact. But the whole thing was just getting too complex. So she knew she needed new rules in that area.
You've mentioned some landmark letters.
I can't remember what they were called now.
There was something having to do with Exxon Capital.
Exxon Capital slightly different there because... The Exxon, those are slightly later, and those are still actually relevant. The ones that were most important in the Reg S area. If I had a textbook around,
okay.
Or actually, it's probably a couple of them must be cited to in the 87 study.
Okay.
Yeah, there was one on debt, and at this point. The international equity markets were a very recent phenomenon at that stage. The debt markets were fairly internationalized, and you'd created the euro markets over in Europe. You had this sort of institutional market floating somewhere off Europe in some ill-defined way. But the equity capital markets were very, very localized and regional until around 1984-5-ish, around there.
Hmm.
And the reasons for that were you got the big privatizations of the Thatcher era, for example, where you had these enormous offerings which the local markets couldn't cope with. And you knew you wanted to come over to the US markets, the biggest, deepest ones. And that's where things started to get complex. And so you had... okay, can we offer in the United States? Do we, you know, we register if we don't want to register, if we just want to sell both in the UK, but in France and you know, Sweden and all of these places? So you're starting to create international links for which there were no rules. So the study... was done. It was a very opportune moment, I think, because you're looking at markets that are probably no more than 5 years old at that stage.
Hmm. I mean, there was a rule, wasn't there, in that they could take the whole thing and reconcile it to
American. You know, if you wanted to do the whole registration, yep, you could do that. But a lot of you know, you take British Gas, reconciling British Gas to you, no, it's just not going to work. So the U.S. markets represented a huge and in those days, I mean, it was the biggest the biggest and deepest market. The Europeans were very fragmented.
Well, how did the push for the rule writing go? You said that there were some things in the works when you came in.
Yeah.
Do you remember what was first?
144A was first. It was being worked on at that time by the regular rule writing guys. And it was at that point seen very much as a we need to give more guidance on the resale of restricted securities. At that point, the industry was operating under Rule 41.5, which didn't, of course, exist, had been created by the industry. So it was a clear need for a rule that said, under what circumstances can I resell securities in a private way? Do I need all of the opinions and things that we're getting at the moment? So there was no liquid way of reselling restricted securities, even to institutions at that stage.
What's this, 401.5?
Yeah, 41.5.
41.5.
Section 41 says resales by anyone other than issuer, underwriter, or dealer are exempt. And Section 42 says private placements are exempt. And so when you try and put them together, you go, okay, well, under 4.1, how do I know, okay, I'm not the issuer because I'm reselling, I'm not a dealer. How do I know I'm not an underwriter? Because statutory underwriter under 2.11 is so broadly drafted. Okay, I'm going to look to Section 4.2 for guidance as to how not to be an underwriter. So you put the two together and you get Section 4.1.5. And it worked. I mean, everybody was was fine on the point of view of, we can give opinions on it. But in order to do that, say I'm a institutional investor, if I want to sell to another institutional investor, I had to get a rep letter and I had to get an opinion of counsel and then I transfer it, which meant this was a very illiquid market, especially when you compared it to what was happening in the euro markets.
Okay.
So... There was a need for liquidity.
And the restriction was there that it had to be unsold for 2 years or something like that.
Two years was for the public markets. That was 144.
Okay.
And this is why it's 144A, because it's sort of like piggybacked on
it.
Right. So it was, whereas 144 was the public resale of restricted securities, 144A was the private resale of restricted securities.
Okay.
And so they'd already been working on that for a while. When I joined the commission.
Okay, so 144A was already in existence. This is
it was in process. It took quite a long way to get it, but they were working on it, and I think they started working on it. Must have been pre October 86. At least a year. I think they'd been sort of kicking it around.
Okay. Well, what was your role in that effort?
I just got assigned to be part of the team, thinking about and writing about it. My role was more on what later became Reg S, which is, it went through so many names, but for a while it was sort of like Regulation 4708, the release upon which all of the existing no action letters was based was Release 334708. So we were working on the successor to that release.
Okay.
And we knew that we had to do the two in tandem because it just gradually became more obvious that the two would work together and that Regulation S, in telling you how you did an offering offshore, would sort of come... And I remember the moment that I realised that 144A had wider implications because I was just gone out to buy my husband a birthday present and I was coming back going, oh my goodness, this is broader than I realised. And I went back to Elise Walter and she said, yes, that is the general idea. She was already... But if you create an institutional market that is liquid... which at first we're just thinking, let's find a way for these poor guys to be able to resell without all these piles of bits of paper and opinions passing. Mm-hmm. If you create a liquid market there, you're actually creating an institutional market that could be like the euro market. So you're almost bringing the euro markets offshore. Mm. And then at some point you start realizing, yeah, these things do go in tandem, because Regulation S tells you how to do an offering that is offshore and not registered with the SEC. 144A tells you how to eventually resell securities that are placed in a restricted way in the US. Therefore, if you go into an offering knowing you're going to use 144A eventually, you have what is called a 144A offering. So this is how to do an unregistered offering, which is eventually we just realized that the two things work together.
So they're two parts of the same process.
Yeah.
And the idea, again, is simply making American markets more attractive, more available.
Yeah. Yeah, just making everything, providing clarity in an area where there really wasn't a lot of clarity. Because you didn't know how you could stay safe from registration if you sold overseas, and you wanted to have some idea of how you could resell if you placed the securities privately in the U.S.
So you ended up focusing more on the Reg S side?
I started off more on the Reg S side, but as it became obvious that the two worked together, and that there would be a package, and then, because I had started working on the rules before I moved over to OICF, at some point, both of those rules ended up in OICF.
Okay. What were the hurdles? What was tough about writing these rules?
I used to work till midnight on Saturdays with this stuff. In some ways, it was very simple. But the problem is, we weren't doing these in a vacuum, so it had to fit in. Everything you did on one side, not only did the two rules have to work together, but they had to work with other rules outside of themselves. I know Reg S can be and is criticized for being far too complex. The problem is that it was very difficult to find a bright line. We wanted to say, if you're selling outside the United States, you don't have to register with the SEC, period. The trouble is, what is outside the United States? If you have some kind of jurisdictional link, one phone call, six phone calls, what happens if you advertise? I mean, luckily, the internet didn't exist then, but it would be the same kind of things. And there was a lot of communications that were transnational by their nature. So the basic principles, we sort of messed around. We had the basic principle, you sell outside the United States. And we had rejected the old principle of if you sell to U.S. persons. As far as we were concerned, the U.S. persons, all persons in the United States are protected, whether they're U.S. or foreign. If a non-U.S. person, if a U.S. person is outside the U.S., they are not going to be protected. I mean, they're not going to take the registration provisions of Section 5 around the world with them, like an umbrella, because there's issues of comity, among other things, and also the need for a bright line. And so it was to protect the U.S. markets, not to protect U.S. investors wherever they might wander.
So you're almost looking at geography and saying, here's where it all changes.
Yeah. And that was, in the changing environment that we were dealing with, that seemed very appropriate, because other people were, we were getting new securities commissions all the time in other countries, and a lot of people were saying, "Hang on a minute, you cannot regulate this stuff that your people are doing in our markets. We regulate that. You regulate this." So. Basic principles were registration provisions are intended to protect U.S. markets, not U.S. persons. Registration provisions are different than anti-fraud. Never gave up for a moment the concept that fraud, wherever it happens, we're going to take jurisdiction over it. basic principle that you needed bright lines so that a company knew exactly what it could do to whom and when, and then just putting all of those concepts together. So the concepts, I think there was very little disagreement on. It's just how you managed to reflect those concepts in a rule.
And there's really only three concepts, I guess.
Those were the primary ones. Everything else flows from those.
So it's a matter of adjusting.
Yeah.
After that.
Yeah.
Okay. How much was the commission involved in all of this?
Fair amount. We did run the rules by all of the commissioners in many different... They saw many, many drafts of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Grunfest, very highly involved. Joe, the funniest Democrat I ever saw, a Chicago school Democrat. absolutely brilliant guy. I loved him. But our first draft we'd sent up to him, and... his assistant, Bernie Black, now Professor Bernie Black, came down with our rule mostly crossed out. He only left the bit that said, what became the general principle, securities sold outside the United States are not subject to registration. They crossed out absolutely everything else. and so we had to work from that. So he was wanting to be very sort of free market libertarian there.
Hmm.
But in the end, we got to a place where... It's okay, you know, all of the rest, however complicated it looks, it's just a way of saying what is inside or outside the United States. Because mm-hmm. I used to tell this joke at conferences, what the basic problems were. There's a bunch of French widows and orphans have boarded a plane in Wales, and they're flying to Iran. And en route, they get hijacked. And the hijacker says, fly me to Cuba. But they run out of gas somewhere in Houston. So they land in Texas. And at that point, there's an Iranian rug dealer who turns to one of the widows and orphans and says, hey, you want to buy some securities? Okay, did that happen in the U.S. or not? you sort of play with that whole example. He makes the offer when they're outside of U.S. airspace. The offer is accepted just as they're taking off and heading for Mexico. You have no idea. I mean, you take your basic contract laws for where an offer and sale takes place, and when you've got telephones and people moving around, you have no idea. So you just provide some absolute clarity and say, okay, at this moment in time, which is when the contract is accepted, the bid, the order is transmitted, that's the point we're looking at. We're going to look at nothing else. And yes, you can play with this, you can manipulate this, that's the whole point. We are providing a bright line here. And so if you want to go offshore specifically to transmit your buy order, then you're doing so knowing that you're leaving behind the protections of Section 5, and that's fine. You do so on the basis of full knowledge. Fraud involved, all bets are off, we don't care where it happened. But here, you know exactly what the rules are, because it's so difficult to... draw the line, so we're drawing it here.
The other thing that stands out in all of this is I guess it's in 144A, which is, the fact that you're ruling out the widows and orphans. They're not mm-hmm. the ones who are buying.
Yeah. I mean, on the widows and orphans, of course, if they choose, could go to Paris and buy hokey securities, but they would be doing so on the basis of full knowledge, we hope. 144A, yeah, the principle is there is some people who, by definition, just do not need the protection of the securities laws. And so why use all of these resources of the SEC in giving people something they don't need? And so when you look at Linda's speeches from this time, she used the phrase, which I hate, as a per se matter, but still, qualified institutional buyers per se do not need the protections of registration, and that's just it. In fact, actually, one of the seminal speeches, I think it's the speech she made, I forget who it was to, but there's a 1987 speech where these principles are set out, and that was one of the crucial moments in international regulatory history, is that speech.
Was this controversial at all? Because in a sense, the SEC is backing away from from something theoretical or not that it used to do.
Yeah. In fact, I was one of the, maybe it was BNA, well, the board members of one of the securities regulatory magazines met, and we had gone over to give them the outline of what we were doing. And I forget who it was. It was somebody important, like Joe McLaughlin or someone like that. But anyways, somebody had this moment of banging the table and saying, this is voodoo regulation, you know, using the voodoo economy thing from the Reagan days. Yes, there was some resistance, not from the bank. And here again, I didn't get the impact of all of this. It's just in my own experience. But there was some resistance from lawyers. There was some resistance. There were questions asked from Congress, I think, but I don't know how they were answered. Mm. I wasn't involved in that bit. I know I appeared on a radio program at one stage where one of the financial ones where the host said, well, how can you justify taking this opportunity away from the widows and orphans?
So that's turning it the other way.
Yeah, exactly. Widows and orphans should have this. So we had to sort of like backtrack on that and say, well, okay, here's the basic principle. 144A was... controversial in some respects. Reg S, I just didn't see that because I think it was just too damn complicated anyway. And it was like, oh yeah, that's foreign. We don't care about that. It's just too complicated. Hmm. But the resistance that existed was on 143.
I mean, was there controversy within the commission?
I don't think so. Not that I was aware of. I mean, I think people realised... You wanted to do two things, which is provide certainty as to when you could resell and have a more liquid market. There was discussion of where we should set the levels of QIB.
Yeah, yeah. Because you ultimately came up with a dollar amount.
Yeah. It's the easiest thing to do. Again, you've got to set the line somewhere. The dollar amount, I think, was... they were always... The general idea was let's just assume that somebody who's managing that amount of money cannot possibly be so dumb they need us to protect them.
Okay. Well, these things all came to fruition about the time you were getting ready to leave.
Yeah, I stayed on, in fact, in order to get them through. We proposed them, and they went as a package, generally. We proposed them in 88. Yeah, it was 88. Mm-hmm. Reproposed in 89. At this stage, and this brings me back to sort of like the beginning of my story, my husband, working for the army, has in the meantime gone back and served in Korea for a year, which meant that working till midnight on Saturdays was really not a problem. Mm-hmm. But he had come back, and he had just been assigned to West Point to teach. And at this stage, it was very difficult being that far apart. At least we were in the same time zone, but we could only see each other weekends. And on two government salaries, we had to wait till late train, 8 p.m. Fridays and 8 p.m. Sundays. Tore the hell out of the weekend. And so I said, I've got to go. I would have stayed at the SEC forever if it had not been for that. I mean, or at least the foreseeable future. I loved the job. It was, I described it, in fact, in my leaving speeches as it was a blessing. You get up every day, you go, okay, I'm going to do something really interesting, and it's kind of significant too, it matters. Mm-hmm. I just loved it. I was learning stuff all the time. The people were fantastic. People just don't realize the quality of the people at the SEC, the fact that you get this quality of people at government salaries when they could be making, I mean, in those days it was twice as much. Now it's like, stupendously, order of magnitude, it's like 10 times as much some of these people could get outside. And yet they stay. Partly there's a bit of lifestyle, although they do work hard. But it's because I think of the same thing. They're doing something interesting and important, and you don't necessarily get that everywhere else. So I would have stayed, but it was just too much strain on finances, just emotionally, not being away so much from my husband. So I stayed through the final adopting. I left the day that we delivered the adopting releases to the commissioners. I saw it through. So I actually, the adopting meeting, 10 days later, I was actually on the other side.
Hmm. And this was the adopting of Red Gas?
And Bonfilly Free.
At the same time?
Yeah. They once we realized how they worked, they went together as a package.
Okay. Well, that draws a nice little line with your career at the SEC, I guess. And then you came back to the same firm, only in New York?
Yes, strangely enough, actually. I'd left it because there wasn't any international work.
Right.
But I talked to a number of firms. Of course, I knew a lot of the Wall Street firms at this stage. But the most interesting offer that I got was from my old firm, who basically said, okay, we don't do any international at the moment, but we're going to build an international practice around you. And, going as the number six person in one of the established firms, I was still very young then. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is, a chance to build something. It was a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to choose your successor at the SEC?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I was involved in that. I mean, Brent Taylor had been my deputy, I'd met a lot with Rich Kosnick as we did the as he considered whether to come over, because Brent and Rich was technically the chief, but Brent was sort of like more than a deputy.
Hmm. Did you have a sense of what they might be facing, of what the next thing coming up was going to be?
There were a few projects that were left undone, some of which took a long time to get through. Rule 801, cross-jurisdictional exchange rights and tender offers, I had worked on, and I don't think it got adopted until about 8 years after I left.
Mm.
There was a lot of interpretation to be done, because of course, once you've got the rules out there, you've got to decide, okay, what are you going to do about those rules now? But it was sort of the reason I could say I will just get these done is because it seemed like that part of life had been done at that point.
And the size of the office when you left?
It was probably still six people, and then it went down.
Okay. So it really did grow to do this very specific task.
Yeah, it was just like World War II Pentagon kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because then interpretations could get moved up to other places, and so.
Okay. Well, then, as you said, you're on the other side all of a sudden, and the newspapers and the financial reporters are coming to you to talk about Red Gas and 144, and all the talk is about this big new market that's going to do amazing things.
Yep.
And it apparently didn't for a while.
It didn't for a while. Although, I was working on. The very first one of the entities that worked very closely with the SEC through the whole of 144A, because they saw the interest in it, was First Boston, later subsumed by Credit Suisse, of course. There were actually quite a few offerings in those. I think if you look at, did the market not happen? The trading market didn't, but the offerings actually did. Because one of the things that, these coincidences that happen in securities law history, at that time, early 90s, you've got Latin America re-emerging from the lost decade, and some securities offerings from Latin America getting it. Now, of course, when we were at the SEC, we thought 144A was going to be used by domestic companies. And we thought disclosure would be very much the, okay, well, we're already registered, so, you know, here's back of an envelope, we're AAA rated, this is the terms, do you want the securities? And, of course, one of the important things about 144A, it is disclosure neutral. It doesn't say anything about the disclosure that's necessary. So you see a kind of very interesting phenomenon here in that people have said, you know, race to the bottom, you know, so you're just letting it. And again, the role that is played by the lawyers and the need for 10b-5 opinions. You've got securities coming from unknown countries, Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, oh my goodness, who are these people? And the investors won't buy unless they get the full story about the securities. The investment bank's internal risk management people say they're not going to permit these things into the United States unless they have a 10b-5 opinion from proper lawyers. And so 144A offering documents that started to come from Latin America and, you know, some other jurisdictions look an awful lot like SEC registrations, with the exception of reconciliation and occasionally some of the compensation information. But they, in order to give the 10b-5s, the lawyer's going to go, okay, I'm going to follow the SEC's rules. And that became the absolute standard very fast for disclosure. So
that you had the 144A document.
Yeah, the 144A offering document. You could not tell the difference between a 144A offering document and an SEC registered document apart from the lack of reconciliation. So you saw the first... and here, I don't know about the domestic side, but the first 144A, at least on the international side, was... I can't remember if it was Atlas Copco or Huhtamäki Oy, but they were both brought to markets by both Scandinavians and both brought by First Boston.
Another thing that came up was this loophole that allowed, and let me see if I get this right, that allowed offshore offers to resell and
that's on the
shift
Reg S
things
side.
Back. Yeah, the Reg S.
Yeah, that was. It's interesting whether you call it a loophole. It led to unintended consequences. That's for sure.
Okay.
That didn't become obvious till the mid 90s, where the rules as they applied then to U.S. companies selling overseas meant that you only had to keep the things offshore for 40 days. And then they could come back, right. And that started to be used to, quote, wash the restrictions off the restricted securities. So you could do, in effect, some of these ended up as being indirect public offerings in the United States, that was closed. I don't think there were really as many as everybody said there were. Me and a colleague did an article about, you know, the wrong target. So
the wrong target being?
You didn't really need to make these into restricted securities. You could have actually focused... I can't even remember my own argument now, but, you know, in retrospect, everything looks a lot... You know, maybe the SEC was righter than we thought, but the market did calm down after that. And what people started doing instead was pipes. I'm not sure that was better than the Reg S offerings.
Pipes?
Private investments in public entities.
Okay.
Which the SEC has never liked very much.
Huh. Why not?
You're taking a public company and you're giving a potential investor a much better deal than the public investors.
Okay.
Basically, a very sound principle. Shouldn't really happen.
Well, then you came back into private practice or into the firm in New York, is that right?
Yeah.
What kind of work did you get involved in?
The rules that I'd been working on. I mean, it worked exactly to plan in that respect. I worked on only on the depository side, not the underwriter side, for on the first 144As. And I did a lot of the stuff. I did ADRs for Citibank. I did 144A offerings. I did Regas offerings. Did eventually a few registered offerings. But very much the flip side of what I've been regulating.
And given that perspective, was there ever a time when you said, "Ah, geez, I shouldn't have done that. I should have changed. I should have written that differently."
Occasionally. I mean, the one actually that I dislike most and still dislike is one of the aspects of 144A that says, you shall not resell within 40 days after. This is category 2 and 3. Didn't like it when we were drafting. I mean, we were drafting this as a committee. It was me and Sam Wolf, who was my deputy at the SEC, who was, we were the ones who did the bulk of the work, supported by the other people in the office. But we were the ones who were there eating pizza at Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And we never quite liked the way that... And that's what led to the loophole as well. There's sort of... It seemed that you were saying, at time X, this shall not have happened for 40 days thereafter. And it was this whole sort of time machine thing. It could have been better drafted. We lost the argument on that we thought that it should be, you shall institute restrictions providing that X might happen. But it's that...
Who did you lose the argument to?
The front office. I forget who it was in the front office, but we lost it. So these things are very much drafted by committee.
But the front office being Linda Quinn? Or
Linda and Elise, and okay. It was just, everybody's putting... it was fantastic to work with. I mean, Linda, like I said, absolutely unsurpassed vision of overview. Elise Walter, the best drafts. My drafting improved so much better. So much... working with her. With so many people putting in their thoughts, they're the things that it would have been better if they'd been more uniform.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you talked about the fact that when you, at the time that you left, you had about 6 people, and the office got smaller again after mm-hmm. that. The interesting thing is, of course, this perception that with the internationalization of the market, the international focus is going to be continually growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of it is just because you no longer needed to just ghettoize the international bits. I mean, there's mm-hmm. international aspects to everything. And the office, I mean, you look now, of course, we had Sarbanes-Oxley in the meantime, which has screwed everything up. But you look at the increase. I mean, I'm pretty sure that there is more. It was like 1,250. I don't know the number. There's a lot more foreign registrants now than there were when I was there. Mm-hmm. So you'd think maybe you need more people. But the office that Paul Dudek heads now is more coordinating and just staying on top and seeing where relief is needed. You don't need to have a separate international section because everything's international. Mm. I mean, every offering. In my day, you'd do offerings that were purely US. That's it. You just, and now, of course, all of the banks are international, so you're not going to be able to say, well, Merrill Lynch can only sell in this area. Of course, everybody else is like, they want a bit sold in their markets too. So growing international means you a less need for an international office.
And when do you think that reached the tipping point where the SEC is about, it's no longer just U.S., but everything's international?
I don't know, because it's reversed. I mean, that's the problem. With Sarbanes-Oxley. Mm. And it's been very sad. I mean, I know that it's good that there be competition between markets. And now the markets that are primarily running the disclosure of many of these companies are very well-run markets. But it's just sad to see someone like British Airways, who is listed here and reporting here, not reporting anymore. Mm. Then there's no reason that should be a necessary thing. It's just the US used to be the centre of the international world, and it's not now, and that's not going to change.
That the whole idea of Sarbanes-Oxley gets to something that's interesting when you look at the discussions that were going on back in the late 80s. The discussion is really around how can we lower, you know, the amount of reduce the amount of information that the issuers have to put out, and and in, you know, the perspective of Enron and all of that.
Yeah.
That seems somehow quaint or curious, and I'm wondering if that ever came up at that time, just the sense that, oh, maybe we took a wrong step.
With respect to lessening
information? Yeah, with respect to making it easier to issue securities.
Making it easier doesn't necessarily mean there's less information, though. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things in a lot of the criticism, where people were going, oh, no, it's a race to the bottom.
Right.
There never was a race to the bottom. There was a race to the top. And what happened was those markets that provided the best disclosure routinely got the best prices. And I think I've spoken in a number of accounting conferences, and there's a lot of learning in the finance journals about the effect that good disclosure regulations have on stock price, because, you know, if you have a more transparent system, you're able to assign a higher value to a security because you don't have to discount the risk for the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the markets actually proved all of the naysayers wrong when they say it's a race to the bottom. There never was a race to the bottom. Disclosure has only improved on a worldwide basis. When you look at 144A, nothing in there about disclosure. You
right.
look at a 144A offering document, you've got some of the best disclosure in the world. You look at the markets in 1980s, look at an offering document for the Eurobonds, no management's discussion analysis. You look at what you have now in the regulated markets in the European Union, you've got it. It's not as good as a one that you would do in the US. Nobody does good MD&As apart from the US, I think, even to this day. But they've got them. They've got the idea that you've got to have more disclosure. And a lot of this happened without mandating extra disclosure. And then you look at Sarbanes-Oxley, and you've got the reverse effect going. Sarbanes-Oxley says more, to the effect, to the point that the companies say, no more, we're out of here. And it's just a shame.
So how has that changed the business that you're doing now?
Hardly ever work on European public offerings in this country. I think those days are really over. We're only going to see the very, very largest companies from Europe coming here for tactical reasons. Maybe they want to take over something over here. Maybe they want more of a presence here. If they have a huge employee base here, those are the things that might cause them to come back, but it's not going to happen very much.
But it's just too much work for them to get involved.
Yeah, and there's no extra bang for the buck now because they've got the quality markets at home. So they're not going to increase their stock price by becoming more transparent because they're already as transparent as the markets require. So whereas I used to do some European offerings, kind of not now. I do a lot of 144A Reg S for Latin American companies, and about 1 in 10 of those so far has eventually come to the regulated to register with the SEC. I'm working on an enormous one at the moment. It's sort of typical of that. It's too big for its home market. It's got to go somewhere else. And the US is the natural place. And Sarbanes-Oxley has been a pain. They've been working on this registration for 5 years. Latin Americans will come to the New York Stock Exchange and the SEC. Europeans, I think we've seen the end of. It's a shame.
Yeah. Well, is there anything that we haven't discussed that is germane? Issues about your time at the SEC? Things you learned?
Not really. It's just like I think the most important thing was it was a fantastic place to work. The people, you know, Linda and Elise, Maury Ashraf, who's still there. Actually, Elise may go back there as a commissioner. The rumours say. Sam Wolf, my deputy. Just, you know, the quality of the people and the willingness to work hard and the amount that you learn. I mean, every associate who's ever asked about going to the SEC, I've always said you can't do better.
Yeah.
If you care about the law, then that's the place to go. And you notice it with associates coming out of the SEC who just have so much better grounding in black-letter law. An associate who's a six-year who's been in private practice the whole of their life, they'll be really good at process, they'll be really good at negotiating and arguing. Not going to be as good as somebody who spent a couple of years at the SEC learning the law.
So you'd probably rather work with someone who's been through the SEC.
I like someone who's got balance, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, occasionally it does actually matter that you know the law. It's, you know, US security source. I occasionally say it's not rocket science, but it's incredibly complex and rule-based and incredibly illogical. I mean, you wouldn't have done this from scratch. You would have built a totally different system. So you've got things piled up on top of each other like Rube Goldberg structures. But it works. Then there is a unifying whole. But you've got to know the rules to know where you can push the envelope.
Well, that's great. That's a good place to stop. Thanks very much.
Thank you.